As John's already said, you come all the way from Peterborough today. Okay, there we go. I'm going to hand you over.
Great. Thank you. I've got one here, so I'll put this down. Great. It's a real, real pleasure to be here. I said to John, I just sort of, in a sense, I've come here. I've only worshipped with you once before, but I kind of feel like I've come home. I know Richard Meikle, I'm sure you know him very well, and he sent me a text this morning, which was lovely, saying, I'm praying for you, Ed, and please pray for me. He's speaking to a bunch of Garrison, I don't know, he's speaking to Garrison since this morning. And again, I know Helen, I know John, I know other people here very well, which is a real joy. So, and to sing that song, you know, in my Father's house, there is room for me. I just thought that's quite relevant, actually, for what we're going to say. And I just, as I was thinking about what to say today, I thought I'd start with Jesus on the cross. His final words was this. He said to his disciple, to John, here is your mother. From that time on, this disciple took her into his home. The final desire of Jesus was for a vulnerable female to be looked after by the church, the nascent church. And in so doing, he also somehow redefined family. He said, this is your mother. We are brothers, we are sisters, we are family. He didn't have a kind of neat 2.4 kids approach to family. He himself was from he was a bastard child, you could argue, and he wants us to be family to vulnerable women. And so John's first thing was to, the first thing the church did was to take in a vulnerable woman. Why? And they did it. Why did she do it? Why did John start a home for vulnerable women right at the start of the church? Because Jesus told him to. Out of obedience to Jesus, he took into his home a vulnerable woman and said to her, there is space for you in my home. So I just wanted to start by encouraging everyone here, because the impression I get about Eagle's Nest is you are doing an amazing job. For 4 or 5 years, you've run a house for the vulnerable women, just as Jesus asked John to do, and you have done it brilliantly. You really have, and it's just important to know that. You have done the stuff really, really well. So be encouraged. I want to just start off by telling you a little bit about Hope into Action, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about a passage from the Bible, The Bleeding Woman, one of my favorite passages, and just talk about what can we learn about Jesus from that passage, and how does that apply to us as we seek to work with vulnerable men or vulnerable women, or those to love people in our community. It's weird, I've got this thing on, I've got an itchy ear. I've never had that before. Hang on a sec. There we go. That's better. So a few years ago, I was kind of in Peterborough, which is where I live, and I was wandering around, and I was kind of in a difficult state emotionally and spiritually. I'd spent 9 years working war zones in Africa. I'd spent 3.5 years. I'm a total muppet. No, here we are. I've got some. We're going to sort my ear out. Great. High maintenance preacher. Too tall. Yeah. Great. Sorry. Speak amongst yourselves. Just an excuse to get close. No, like that. Keep going. I'm enjoying this. It's lovely. My wife's away. Right. Okay. So let me go. So a few. What's that? Oh, God, sorry. Don't apologize. Right. Vulnerable women. Where was I? Let's go. So there I was in the playground with my daughter, and I'd kind of been going through this kind of existential wranglings and wondering, you know, I'd spent 9 years overseas in Africa, and I thought, how do verses like Isaiah 58 apply? Isaiah 58 says, this is the kind of worship I'm after, to loose the chains of injustice, to set the oppressed free, to provide the poor wanderer a shelter. And I was like, now I'm in Peterborough, how does this work, and what exactly do I do with these verses? I don't understand how this works. It was 2008, it was the height of our boom, we were doing really well. I'm in the playground, I meet someone on the bench, and I couldn't quite work him out, because he kind of looked like a, excuse the French, he kind of looked like a guy was homeless, but he was kind of quite clean cut, and it didn't kind of fit the image. So I got speaking to him. His story is the same story you will hear hundreds of times in our country every year. Even last week, I got a phone call from the chaplain at Peterborough Prison saying, Ed, we've got someone who is coming out on Monday. They have nowhere to go. They've come to faith in prison. What are you going to do about him? Now, this is now our normal Open to Action. But back then, I was naive. I didn't know about this stuff. And this guy's story was that morning, he'd come out of prison. And he was walking out the prison gates full of determination and hope that fresh start was going to make it going to go good and clean this time. As he was walking out the prison gates, a prison officer said to him, we'll see you back here in 3 months' time, mate. Any sense of sort of self-esteem or hope crumbled. And I'd met him. The sun was still rising. He was already through a bottle of something pretty strong. And he'd actually made a rational choice because he had nowhere to go. And I said, well, look, I'm working on some hostels. I'll try and help you. I could find nowhere that would take him. He was too old, or they don't take what we call ex-offenders. So, okay, don't worry, I'll find somewhere in Norwich for you. No, none would take him. Too old, and they don't take people to come out of jail. So I was like, this is really bad. Where were you before you were in prison? He said, I was in Cambridge. Cambridge, you think of it as this really nice place. Actually, it's the most unequal city in the country. Well, what were you doing in Cambridge? He said, if I go back to Cambridge, I will end up surrounded by the same old people doing the same old things. I will end up back inside in 3 months' time, so I'm not going back to Cambridge. So he'd made a rational choice. He had nothing to do. He had 47 quid. And what else are you going to do with the money? And I left that place, and I felt really, one, disempowered. I couldn't help this guy. I felt disempowered. And the second thing I felt was really angry. And I thought, why aren't the churches doing stuff about this? What is the point of all this worship in this city I've just moved to if we're not doing something about... Oh, and then I remembered those verses that I'd loved so much in Stan. Isn't this the kind of worship I'm after? To loose the chains of injustice, to set the oppressed free, and to provide the poor wanderer with shelter. I was like, oh, right. There's still poor wanderers in this city. There's still poor wanderers in this country. There's loads of them. And now I've got into this business, and other people here, James knows far more than I do. There are loads and loads of people still who, for whatever reason, could do with a home. And you guys, as a church, you do provide a home. So again, congratulations. That was about 10 years ago. Have we got a PowerPoint? Yeah. The good news is we've moved on from there. We now have, as you see, over 50 houses. We've actually got 63 homes for the homeless in partnership with 55 churches. So we've really grown, and it's just been amazing to see what God has done, because every day, every week, it feels like now we're getting people phoning us up and going, do you know what? Do you like to partner with my church? Or do you know what? I've got a bit of money. Can you buy a house with that? And just like, we're not actually doing anything but responding to the phone calls, and we've gone from nothing to 63 houses, and we've got another 10 in the pipeline, including another two more here in Nottingham, which is absolutely wonderful. So very quickly, I'll tell you how we do it with every single house. Our approach and our model has not changed from day one, though the people in our houses has changed. We've now got houses for refugees. We've got houses for people coming out of modern slavery. We've got houses for people fleeing domestic violence. We've got houses for men who slept on the streets, people coming out of rehabs and so on. But our model hasn't changed, and it's just this one. If you click on the next one. That's our poor wanderer. He's left the prison this morning. He's got nowhere to go and no one to go to. Next click. Oh, that's not right. Okay, go back up. Try again. Keep going down. One more click. Yeah. Using investment capital, we buy a home for that guy who's just come out of prison. And every home is always, always, always in partnership with the church, because we never want to lose our spiritual edge as an organization. Click down next. The church try and provide a family of people to love and befriend the tenants in the house. Next click. And then we always provide a professional to work alongside the church to make sure what we're doing is quality and to cover things like housing benefits and so on. So that's our model, which we've used wherever we've gone, whatever we've done. If you go down to the next click, and we've done that across 63 homes around in 19 towns. and we'll be in 20 towns by the end of the year, probably. So that is Hope into Action. And the thing about Hope into Action that we would say is central and remains central is this sense of that guy who I met on the bench. If you cast your mind back to him, we would say his physical poverty, his homelessness, was a function of a deeper need. And that deeper need is a relational poverty. Because when he came out of prison, he had nowhere to go, and his nowhere to go was a function of having no one to go to. Does that make sense? If you come out of prison today and you've got no one to go to, that's a fairly lonely place you've got yourself in or you found yourself in. And what we want to try and do is try and meet that need by kind of providing relational richness. And in this room is enormous relational richness. And you've already shown that you've provided that to a number of people. And going back to that thing of the cross, his mother was homeless, but he put her in her family and said, here is your, this is, he connected them emotionally. Does that make sense? So right at the heart of Jesus' outreach, when John took in that vulnerable woman, was a sense of, you are now part of our family. In your father's house, in our father's house, there is room for you. There is space for you. In this church, there is space for you. There is room for you. So we have this relational approach to everything that we do. Jesus said that three times that you would meet him once he's gone. Three times. He guaranteed he would rock up. The first is when we gather, when two or three gather, here, you know, there he is. So this morning, Jesus is with us. The second, he promises that when we share bread and break wine, when we break bread, have some wine, when we do the Eucharist, Jesus is there. Both of those religious rituals draw us into relationship. You can't gather as two and three unless you're with someone else. You can't share bread and wine unless you do it in relationship. So those religious rituals, which we all observe, draw us into relationship. The third and final way that Jesus says, you will meet with me, was also in relationship. And he said it when you engage with those who've been in prison, with those who are in hospital, with those who are strangers, those people who are strange to you, those people who have different language, different way of living, when you welcome them, you will meet with Jesus himself. So once again, Jesus rocks up when we do relationship and we do it well. He does it in church, in Eucharist, and the third place is when we meet with others who are on the edge of our society. That is when we grow. Why do we grow? Why do we meet with Jesus? Because Jesus speaks to us through them. Our judgmentalism kind of erodes and subsides. We listen to their issues, we listen to their stories, and our love grows inside us. Our sense of humanity increases as we connect with people who might be strange to us, who might be in prison, who we thought, oh, they're bad people, they're in prison. And yes, I'm not saying we're against the criminal justice system, but it's the sense of our love grows as we connect with people on the edge of society. And as our love grows, we meet with Jesus, we become more like Jesus, because Jesus is God and God is love. And so that is really our mission. At the heart of our mission is to get people into relationship, in an effective long-term relationship with those on the edge of society, so that they can feel like they belong in society, in church, whether they come to formally worship in church or not, or whether they're just part of a group of people that make them feel, no, you're okay, you're loved. That's what we're aiming for. You're valuable. You have innate value. Why? Because God loves you, and he died for you, and he's got a house for you, and he wants to be with you. And that's our central message, and that's the way we go about it. Everyone with me so far? I just thought I'd tell you one story, because it's quite good fun, about how we ended up in Nottingham. There I was, really stressed out. We had 5 or 6 or 7 houses at this stage. I can't quite remember how many. I was quite stressed because I couldn't kind of handle all these houses. And I get a phone call from a vicar in Nottingham, in the Meadows. And he goes, Ed, I've heard what you're doing. Really like it. Can you come to Nottingham? I'm like, man, I'm really stressed. this is really annoying, actually. So I say, well, my wife's pregnant with our third child. She's about to give birth. Do you mind if you call me back in a month's time? And I'm like, just basically buying myself some time, assuming he'll never call me back. A lot of vicars don't call me back, it's my experience. So I kind of assumed he wouldn't call me back. Anyway, I have the baby, all great, back at work now. And he calls me back in a month's time, and he goes, oh, I'm like, flipping heck, what is it with this guy? So he goes, Ed, you said to call me back in a month's time. I go, yeah. you know, I was stressed before. I've now had a baby. I'm now even more stressed. So, okay, I'm still stressed, but I'll listen to your call. I'm trying to put him off the scent, and I'm going, okay, the trouble is, mate, you know, if you want to partner with us, you're going to have a house, a church. And he goes, that's fine. I'm a church leader. I've got that. Tick. What next? And I go, well, if you want, what you really need is a group of 6 to 12 people that can, you know, commit to building relationships. He goes, that's fine. I've got that. No problem. I'm like, man, I can't. I said, well, the other thing you need at least £40,000 of capital to put into a house. He goes, oh. We're a really small church, and we're in the meadows, and we don't have any rich people in our church. Sorry, mate. And I go, well, don't worry. If God's in it, you know, it'll be all right. And sort of finally shake him off, put down the phone, crack on with something important. Half an hour later, my phone goes. I pick it up. It's Dave Hammond again, you know. And I was like, oh, man, what is this man? What? So I pick it up. He goes, Ed, guess what? What? I've just found £40,000. I was like, what? So anyway, turns out after I shrugged him off and he put the phone down, he sat in his office and he prayed. He walked out of his office. One of his parishioners comes and goes, Dave, just had a letter this morning. My wife and I didn't know. We just had £40,000 come through. And, you know, we just wondered, we just thought we'd ask you what we should do with it. And he's like, let me tell you what you should do with it. So that is how we got into Nottingham about 6 or 7 years ago. That was the first house. And we've now got 6 houses. 2 more in the pipeline. We work with James, we've worked with Helen, we've worked with loads of other people, worked with Kerry, we've worked with loads of people, and it's been an absolute pleasure to be there and to do it. And at this point, I'm going to read the Bible. We're going to read the Bible, and we're just going to read one of my favourite stories, and we're going to see, right, what can we learn from Jesus, and how does that apply to us at Hope Interaction and what we want to be doing? And then I will shut up. So, I'll have to read it with my back to you, is that okay? And a woman was there who'd been subject to bleeding for 12 years. She'd suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors and spent all she had, yet instead of getting better, she grew worse. When she heard about Jesus, she came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak because she thought, if I can just touch his clothes, I'll be healed. Immediately, her bleeding stopped and she felt in her body she was freed from suffering. At once, Jesus realized that power had gone out from him. He turned around in the crowd and asked, who touched my clothes? You see people crowding around you, asked his disciples, and yet you can ask, who touched me? But Jesus kept looking around to see who had done it. Then the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell at her feet and, trembling with fear, told him the whole truth. He said to her, my daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace and be free from your suffering. So I love this. So just to give the context to this, Jesus is walking along. He meets a really rich or kind of powerful religious ruler called Jairus or something. And this guy says, my daughter, who's about 12, is really ill and she's about to die. So Jesus is like on a mission. Now, if I'm Jesus, I'm running a ministry, I'm thinking this is really cool because I've got this really important, powerful man. If I heal his daughter, he's bound to give me money. He's bound to support my ministry, and he's bound to do really, you know, he'll get me to speak at his synagogue. I'm gonna cane it. It's going to be great. So he's like, this is cool. I'm going to go and sort this person out. It's critical. The person is dying. And then this woman comes and touches him. Now, this woman is of not very high repute. She would have been looked down upon, and she would have been judged because she's still bleeding. She shouldn't be out of the house if she's bleeding. And she's broken the law by touching Jesus. Now, in this situation, I'm like, right, I know that God loves, I've got to sort this woman out, but frankly, this is more important. She's been bleeding for 12 years, she can bleed for another few minutes, right? I'm not going to deal with her, I'm going to deal with this child that's about to die. No, Jesus stops and gave her the time in front of everyone else over this religious person. And I love the way Mark has written this story because it's like he's kind of wound up the tension, like a soap opera. You know, there's a soap opera crescendos towards the end and then it ends and you're like, drat, what's the ending? You have to wait till next week to find out. And you can imagine if this was a soap opera, you've got there, bang, it finishes. You've got Jesus, panning in Jesus. What does he do? Do I carry on with Jairus? Or do I give my attention to this woman? You've got Jairus, who's really important and is used to people doing what he says, and it's like, man, will you, you know, we've all suffered road rage. This is like road rage to the max he's going through. My daughter is dying. What are you doing? Hanging around with this silly woman. Leave her alone. Come with me. That's what he's going to be thinking. You've got the disciples going, what's Jesus on this time? Loads of people are in touch with you. Get a grip. And you've got the crowd who are like, this woman, she's bleeding. Disgraceful woman. You can see some, the men tutting and going, oh, can you see her bloody rag? That is a disgrace. She should not be allowed out. And the women who have kept themselves clean all their lives, they've looked down on her as well because they're like, I would never do that. I would never be out. And then Jesus is stuck in the middle of all these different opinions and the soap opera ends and you've got to wait till next week to see what he does. So you come back next week and up goes the kind of, whatever it is, the curtain, and you see Jesus. Jesus, this enormous pressure on Jesus, emotional pressure, the current of opinion was to dismiss this woman, to tell her off, and go instead with Jairus. And what Jesus does, just to put this in context, if you were a woman who was bleeding, you weren't allowed to touch anyone else, you weren't allowed to be near anyone else, you weren't allowed to engage in any social activities, any economic activities, any religious activities, you shouldn't be seen or heard or anything like that, she'd be touched away. This was a disgrace what she'd done. This was not a good thing. And Jesus would have known the law, and instead he prioritized her over Jairus, and he sorted her out. So there are just three or four things I want to just bring out of this. Where do we place our priorities? Where do we place our priorities? Jesus had a choice between the critical, a girl who's going to die, and the chronic. Between the religious and the rejected. Between the law and between love. He rejected the religious in favor of the ostracized. He wasn't too bothered about legal, theological stuff if it meant he couldn't love this lady. Where do we place our priorities? When Jesus stopped and he touched that girl and he brought that girl up, what he did in that moment is he smashed through centuries of religious oppression against women. He smashed through centuries of religious oppression against women because the religion had said you can't go out, you can't engage in educational activities, you can't engage in social activities, you can't engage in religious activities, and that held women back. And he smashed through that wall and lit a fuse of liberation that continues to this day. There is still a lot of period poverty out there. Overseas, there's tons of it. Still, girls aren't going to school. But most people in this country, 4 weeks out of four, can engage in economic, social, and religious activities. And it started by this man, Jesus. He lit a fuse of inspiration by liberating women and allowing women to engage in activities. And I like to think that night, as Jairus, this religious man, was kissing his daughter now on the cusp of puberty, as he was kissing his daughter goodnight, he reflected and thought, do you know what? I'm going to give my daughter and my wife just a little less grief over some of these religious rules that I've been carrying all my life. And I'm going to see my daughter and my wife liberated into the fullness of life because Jesus set an example of love over law. And where do we set our priorities? Do we love people? We can get so tangled up, don't we, with kind of, you know, thinking about tongues and, salvation. When is someone coming to faith? When aren't they? And, I don't know, how you do worship. By the way, loved your worship today. Really great. Thank you. Genuinely. Loved it. And actually, in the midst of all that, we're forgetting to love each other and we're forgetting to love those the world has rejected. Jesus, this radical man, chose love over law, the rejected over the religious, and the chronic over the critical. And in so doing, smashed through religious oppression that had been withstand for ages. So that's the first point. Just as we reflect on Jesus, how can I be like Jesus? How can we give time to the women in our society who need it the most? The second thing is just an understanding again of this kind of relational poverty that he perceived in this lady here. And we saw it again. He puts people in relationship. We saw it on the cross. His mother goes to John. John, she is now your mother. John welcomed her into his home. He redefined family. And all through the Mark, actually, if you read it, just before this, we've read about the demon-possessed man who was out in the tombs, who was homeless, who was self-harming and was crying out. And no one could touch him because he was so violent, and they tried to chain him up and they couldn't. He was a prolific offender. And Jesus saw through all that stuff and saw a person crying out for a relationship, crying out for love, and healed him. Before that, we had, in Mark, we had the paralytic man. And when Jesus healed him, he again placed it and said, now you go home. What he said to the demon-possessed man was, you go back to your family. Well, one of the other Gospels says, go back to your community. And so you see, and this lady here says, my daughter, you are my daughter. And so you see Jesus on the cross with the bleeding woman, with the demon-possessed man, with the paralytic. He's placing people into relationships. And that is what we need. God's first ever thing he commented about man was this: it is not good for man to be alone. That's the first thing God said in Genesis. We need and we are built for relationship. Our religion calls us into relational richness. And Jesus, when he did a healing, he then said, and now go into your family, go into a community. When he healed the man of leprosy, who also would have felt this kind of searing ostracization from society, total exclusion from society, after he healed him, he said, now go and show yourself to the priest and join a worshiping community. He placed him in community. And so actually, the healing didn't finish when Jesus touched the man of leprosy. Does that make sense? The healing is ongoing for all of us as we are in community and surrounded by love and relationships. And this, I think, is a really important point, because let me tell you a story about one of my trustees. One of my trustees worked for 6 years as a prostitute in Southampton. She's written her book and a story. It's an incredible story. And she was addicted to heroin. And that's how she got through the punters. She didn't have a day off for 6 years. She was on the streets day and night, or through all weathers, working the streets. She got beaten up by her pimp so bad she was in hospital in Bournemouth. And a lady walked into the hospital and said, Linda, I've been looking for you. Do you want to accept Jesus into your life? Put her hands on this lady. And in that moment, Linda accepted Jesus into her life. Not only that, but she was completely released from her addiction to heroin. Now, anyone who knows anything about heroin knows that is an incredible miracle. It's to be released from heroin is an amazing miracle. Very, very few people get that overnight. But Linda would say her healing didn't finish there. She's now been married for 30 years, this week I think it is, but her healing is ongoing. Because the situation she went through, the damage that was done to her, the rape she experienced, all those kind of things weren't sorted in that moment. Does that make sense? And actually, as we all reflect on ourselves, I am a person that is being transformed into Jesus' likeness all the time. I haven't been transformed, I'm being transformed. Does that make sense? And so when Jesus healed these people, he healed the woman, he healed the leprosy, he healed the demon-possessed man, the healing wasn't done then. That was the beginning of their healing. And then he placed them in community, surrounded them in love, and the healing is ongoing for all of us in that community. So some charities say, we transform lives. We've resisted saying that because I don't think we do. We are all being transformed in likeness. And I think this expectation that actually someone can turn from this to this in a moment or a blink of an eye or a weekend is actually setting us up for a false expectation of what God can do, our tenants can do, or the vulnerable can do, and what we can do if we're befriending people. Does that make sense? We are all works in progress. And if you speak to my wife, I have a very long way to go. So you get the point. And so that's the second point. The first point is, you know, what are our time priorities? Everyone here, we can focus on Jesus and we can say, I want to love. I can be part of a community that loves the rejected over the religious. And we can engage in relational richness, which brings us and them healing. And we can grow in our humanity through the difficulties of relationship and the love of relationship. And the third thing is just that Jesus chose love. He chose love over religion. He didn't get bogged down in kind of, well, I don't know, what's the kind of, should she be touched, shouldn't she, is she disgraced, or is she, should I, blah, blah, you know, tongues, what the religious stuff that is actually really important. I shouldn't mock it, actually, because it's really important that people think this stuff through, but not to the detriment of love. We shouldn't get so hung up on, I'm right about this, and you do Eucharist this way, and you do it that way, therefore, you know, fine, just whatever. Let's love each other as we work this stuff out. And let's love those outside of here as we work this stuff out. Because that's what Jesus chose time and again. Do I choose the religious rightness, which means I won't love this person? No, absolutely not. I'll choose love. So that was the third thing. First was he prioritized people, then relational riches. Third thing is love. And the fourth one is more difficult. What did Jesus not say to this woman? Which is a really interesting point, because as we go out and we meet with people, male or female, who are in vulnerable situations, been through some stuff, what did Jesus say and what did he not say? And what did he not say to this woman that just two chapters before in Mark he'd said to the man who's paralytic? Which is really interesting when you think about it. He said to the man who's paralytic, your sins are forgiven. He didn't say that to this female. And why is that? Now, I'm not saying I fully understand the answer. It may be he just forgot. But it may be for another reason. And I don't. But I think it might have something to do with the difference between shame and guilt. The difference between shame and guilt. Guilt is quite easy to understand, right? So I come up and I smack the pastor's wife. I am guilty. Everyone's seen me do it. I need to be forgiven for that sin, right? If I repeatedly smack the pastor's wife behind closed doors, I am a sinner. How is she feeling? She might feel ashamed. She hasn't done anything wrong. It would be foolish for me, it would be absurd of me to go, you're forgiven for the fact I hit you. So I hit the pastor's wife, you're forgiven. Be forgiven. That would be an absurd thing for me to say. Actually, it would be a really harmful thing for me to say, because in the back of my mind is this narrative, maybe I deserved it. Maybe I should have got beaten up. Maybe he was right. He's a pastor. Oh. And I say you need to be forgiven. It's compounding a narrative in her head that it was her fault that she got beaten up. That's shame. Does that make sense? I once spoke to a man, actually was in this city, and none of you know him, so I can share the story. And he disclosed to me how he'd been raped, in quite a lot of detail. If I'd said to him, you can be forgiven for that rape, that would have been a very foolish thing to do, wouldn't it? It would have sent entirely the wrong message. And I think that's partly why Jesus here didn't say your sins are forgiven. So I think there are times where we need to say your sins are forgiven, and there are times where that might not be appropriate. And Jesus' message might be a better one. So what did Jesus say? He says, first of all, daughter, everyone here has space in Jesus' house. Jesus loves everyone here. You are his daughter. Absolutely. And that brings us a sense of healing. Your faith has healed you. He didn't take any glory upon himself. You have done so well. Because you've been beaten up for the last 6 months. You're still going. Well done. You have done so well. You're doing really well. Your faith has healed you. Now be free from your suffering. Is that what it said? Yeah, and be free from your suffering. There's something, isn't there, about that? Your faith has healed you, past tense. Be free from your suffering, future tense. He's not referring to her bleeding there, because that's already sorted. Her bleeding stopped. Be freed from your ongoing suffering on shame. Does that make sense? So it's a sense of, in the future, be free from your suffering, because you are worth something. And you're not what people said you were about you. You're not dirty. You're not a disgrace. You couldn't do anything about the fact you were bleeding. And that wasn't a sin. You've done nothing wrong. You are my daughter. Does that make sense? And that, for people who are suffering shame, as we all suffer, might be a better message. God loves you as you are. Where you are. Even if you relapse tomorrow, God absolutely loves you. In the mess. As you are. So that was my fourth point. The first point was, as we think about what we're doing in Hope into Action, we want to prioritize those the world rejects. We want to prioritize relationship. And we, right at the heart of what we do is relationships. And we're about the church giving relationships because the church has so many powerful relationships you can offer. I'm looking around, I'm seeing a church rich in relationships. And you don't find many organizations that defines its success as what the church does. We define our success as when you guys are loving. We're also an organization that has at its heart love. You go and look on any homeless organization and you try and find out what their mission and vision is and all that kind of stuff is and what they define as success, you won't find the word love. It's really weird. It's so obvious. We think we should love people. That's kind of what we place at the center of all our mission, vision stuff. And we try and understand how to do that in the way Jesus did it. Sometimes we need to talk about forgiveness. Sometimes we don't. So I'm going to end there. I know there are loads of people here that may want to share something or say something. I know Helen does. If you guys want to get involved in working in the house with us, please do. I would say, you know, we've won awards a lot recently. This time last year, we won an award for being the best housing charity in the country. And when I talk to people about that, they notice the work done by this church. I would say that. So you are doing great, great stuff. Helen was wanted to say something, I think, if that's okay. And if anyone else wants to say anything, then do. And that's me. Do get involved if you're not already.